Hi, this is Ross Parker, Dean of the School of Christian Studies here at Charleston Southern University, and we want to welcome you to another Church and Gospel podcast. Here at Church and Gospel, we're interested in showing how the gospel affects every aspect of life. And today, we're going to continue a conversation that began a while back. We're going to be talking about the history of the Bible, and with me today, I have my good friend Ed Gravely. Ed,
hello.
Good to have you.
Hey.
So, like I said, we're continuing a conversation that started back in a podcast that was posted in May, so I'd encourage you to take a look back at that, but we're going to kind of dive into some further issues with this. So, Ed, maybe we can just start by letting you tell us a little bit about what you want to continue on with today.
Sure. So in the last podcast, we just sort of talked about the preliminaries to the Bible, understanding things like a codex and ancient letters and how they were collected and that sort of thing. And that naturally leads us to the question of the canon. Why do we have the 27 books in the New Testament that we have? Why are there not more? Why are there not less? Why do we have the 39 books in the Old Testament? You know, why not 42 or why not 12? And so the canonization of the New Testament is probably the next thing we would want to look at if we were talking about the history of the Bible, because that happened very, very, very early in the life of the Bible.
Okay. Well, good. Well, that term canon, that's familiar to us, but maybe we just want to say a little bit about what we're talking about when we talk about canon and canonization. We're not talking about a big gun.
No. This is not a cannonball, though that is interesting. That would be an interesting podcast as well. No, the word canon, here's the nerd part. The word canon is actually from a Greek word, a Koine Greek word, kanon, which means a reed. And they would, in construction projects, they would cut these reeds and use them like yardsticks. They're like measuring sticks. So in the modern day, we use the word canon to sort of describe like the official collection. You know, if you were if you took an English lit course in your university, you know, you probably heard people talk about, you know, the great canon of British literature, or the canon of African American literature, or the canon of classical literature, and it's just sort of a what's in and what's out in terms of sort of the official greatness, if you will. And that term, we use that term in the New Testament to ask the question, why do we have the 27 books? Why were some excluded and some included, and on what basis?
Okay. So you mentioned there why were some excluded, some included. So that implies that there were some books at this time that aren't in our canon. So how did that process go? Or why do we have these and not others?
Yeah, sure. So there's sort of a complicated mix of both time and the work of the church, which we would also include the work of God. So there are, when you said, there are books from back then that were not included in the canon, we want to be more careful and divide that into two different categories. So we are fairly confident that there are works of the apostles even that did not make it into the canon. And when I say did not make it, don't panic over that phraseology. So for example, Paul mentions in 1 Corinthians a previous letter that he wrote to the Corinthians. So there's a work by the apostles that did not, quote unquote, I'm doing air quotes, make it into the canon. And it was intentionally excluded from Paul's collection, almost certainly by Paul himself, because its contents are summarized in 1 Corinthians 5. And because it was not an open letter written for all churches to read everywhere, like the letters of Paul that we have in the New Testament, but rather it was very much personal correspondence and personal correspondence only. It's not lost to us. We know exactly what it said because he repeats it in 1 Corinthians 5. But that's different than the other books, the books we most normally think of when we think of books that have been excluded from the New Testament, because they are uniformly not from the time of the apostles. There are some that are pretty close. The Didache would be one, the Shepherd of Hermas. But most of the ones that we think of as having been excluded from the canon, the Gospel of Thomas and the Apocalypse of Peter and those, what we think of as the New Testament Apocrypha, they are actually from a century later, and which is the basis on which, we'll get to this, I think, but on the basis on which the church excluded them. In other words, the church said, this was not written by Thomas. Where has it been for 100 years? Thomas has been long dead before this thing ever came around, so it doesn't belong.
Okay. Well, that's already kind of getting at this question of, what was the process or what were the indicators whereby we have these books and not the other. So you talked a little bit about time, but let's maybe flesh that out a bit more.
Sure. So the main work of collecting, as we talked about in the last podcast, the main work of the collection of the scriptures was done by the apostles themselves. So Paul is almost certainly the one collecting his own letters together. John is probably collecting his letters together. And we know this because these things emerge very early. And interestingly enough, it is in the, so to get a bit of chronology, when I say early, if you think Jesus is born 4, 5, 6 BC, somewhere around there, and I know that's weird that Jesus was born 5 years before Christ, but they just got the calendar mixed up a little bit. So Jesus is born probably 5 BC. He dies somewhere between 30 and 33, AD 30 and 33. So that there's a marker, right? The death of Jesus around AD 30. You have the last book of the New Testament then being written probably around 90. That's probably the Gospel of John, the Book of Revelation, one of John's letters. I tell my students if around 90 is a date for all five of those, they'll probably be okay. And so we're now at AD 90. Well, very shortly after that, we have evidence that the writings of the New Testament were considered authoritative and were already collected and circulating. So, you know, we have in the late 90s, we have scholars, churchmen, quoting from the books of the New Testament and calling them scripture. We have a manuscript fragment of the Gospel of John that was, you know, that's already been copied and circulating. The manuscript probably dates to AD 125, and it's already in a library in Africa, a collection of scrolls in Africa. It's P52 for you text critical nerds out there. And so There's plenty of this evidence that the scripture was being collected and was circulating together. Some of the most interesting evidence in that, though, actually comes from Christianity's opponents. And so there are these in the middle of the second century, so 60, 70 years after the New Testament is finished, there are these controversies that emerge in the church. One of the controversies was over a guy named Tatian, and Tatian wanted, and this is an oversimplification, but Tatian had this idea that four gospels seems like three too many. And so what we need to do is we need to just take all the gospel stories and harmonize them into one single account that tells the life of Jesus. And he called it the Diatessaron. And the church reacted very strongly to that because in their reactions, we know, and in Tatian's work, we know that by that point, there were four gospels. In fact, the word Diatessaron affirms that there he's trying to produce one gospel out of four. And I realize that sounds kind of like trivia from history, but it's actually very instructive. If you were to grab any Christian in the world in the second century and ask them, how many gospels are there? They would say there are four. There's Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Another villain that sort of arises there in the second century is Marcion, and he's sort of the first anti-Semite Christian. And he's trying to sort of get he believes that the New Testament has been corrupted by Jews and Judaism, and he wants to get the Jewish influence out of the New Testament. And so he begins to work to have books excluded from the New Testament. You guys shouldn't be reading this. You know, don't read this book, don't read that book. And the church responded to Marcion, and we have recorded in those discussions an affirmation of what books the church was reading. So when Marcion says, you guys need to stop reading Matthew and Hebrews, that tells you that the early church in the second century considered Matthew and Hebrews to be in the canon of Scripture. And so through that process, we realized that really by the middle second century, the Bible the Christians had then looked just like the New Testament the Christians have today.
So you're making this argument that this collection was done very early on.
Yes.
That goes against what you may hear on TV or news articles around the time of Easter or Christmas, where these things come out so often, where this process didn't really take place till, you know, several centuries later. So where is that coming from?
Well, it's coming from a couple of things. It's coming from some older assumptions about the date of some of the books of the New Testament, which have largely been disproved. So if you were to go to our library, the library here at Charleston Southern University, and you were to get all the commentaries on the Gospel of John off the shelf, and you looked at all the commentaries that were written in the early 20th century, you know, say 1930 and before, they're going to have a date for the Gospel of John of late 2nd century. But all of the ones who were published after P52 is discovered, which makes a late 2nd century date ridiculously impossible, they're going to all have an earlier date for John. And so that's a huge component of it. The other component of it is, as I think, is just this broad misunderstanding of how the letters were collected. So, and we talked about this in the last podcast. People have this idea that it wasn't until the second or the third century that somebody scratched their head and thought, you know, Paul was kind of an important guy. Maybe we should try to get all his letters together. And that's just not the way ancient letters were collected and circulated. And some of it's theologically motivated. Some of those claims are being made by people who don't believe that some of the books in the New Testament were written by the apostles themselves. And that, of course, requires a much later date to sort of pull off that kind of forgery. So I think that's where all that comes from.
Okay. But this should give us some confidence as we're thinking about how this collection was formed, that these theories that are put forward, that it took place later and it was political, really just don't match up with the evidence that we have.
They don't. And a little bit of evidence in this case really does go a long way. So a couple of other pieces of evidence, this is kind of hard to do. It's easier for me to do with a PowerPoint in my classroom. It's kind of hard to do on audio. But if you'll think about the books of the New Testament, they have fairly uniform naming conventions. So the Gospels are always the Gospel according to, and then the name of the author. Paul's letters are always to the, and then the name of the recipients. The general letters, what we call the general epistles or the Catholic epistles, it doesn't mean Roman Catholic, it just means general. The Catholic epistles are always the name of the author. And then if there's more than one of them, you number them with an alpha, a beta, gamma, you know, as 1, 2, 3. And that naming convention is ancient. It goes back to the earliest manuscripts we have that have titles. Now, some of those really old manuscripts, we don't know what their titles were because we only have fragments of pages. But they are those naming conventions go back that far. And now they're embellished, so it might be the most holy gospel of, you know, St. Matthew of whatever, but it is the gospel according to, and even in Greek, there's a naming convention with the noun cases even. And I think that's pretty strong evidence that there was a very, very early edition or editions of the New Testament in which these naming conventions were established. One more piece of evidence is really hard to do in audio is there is in the ancient Greek manuscripts a kind of abbreviation that scholars call the nomina sacra. And what it is, we have no idea why it happened. We have no idea whose idea it was. We're not even sure what they intended, but they abbreviate sacred words, the names for God. So very often in these ancient manuscripts, you will not see the word Jesus, Jesus, spelled out. It'll be the first letter, iota, and the last letter, sigma, with a macron over the top. First letter, last letter, like we might abbreviate, Jesus is JC or something like that. That sounds a little disrespectful, but cultures have different ways of abbreviating these things. They would abbreviate them, first letter, last letter, with a macron, that's a line, over the top. And nobody knows who did it, but the nomina sacra exists in a wide number of these ancient manuscripts, going all the way back to the earliest manuscripts. They exist in manuscripts from every part of the world, and that phenomena of abbreviating like that does not exist outside of the New Testament anywhere. It is a purely New Testament phenomena. So somebody very early did that, and it was copied. And that tells you that the New Testament was put very early into a book, and that book, by all the evidence, looks like the book we have. In fact, it's very common to think of the New Testament as being circulated on scrolls, but with a handful of exceptions, every ancient manuscript we have of the New Testament is written on the front and the back, recto verso. So they were pages out of a book. So that New Testament was compiled very, very early, much earlier than what the History Channel is going to tell you at Easter. And the things that book did, or those early editions did, were copied in almost all of the manuscripts, no matter what part of the world you're in.
Okay. So this goes against what you may hear, but it really seems like it's backed up by really solid evidence that we can build off of. Now, are there any other things that we want to say about the New Testament canon in terms of, we've talked about Paul's letters, we've talked about the Gospels. What about maybe some of the general epistles or...
Yeah, so there is. Now, if you read good books on the history of the Bible and the canonization of Scripture, or you take my class on the history of the Bible, which you probably should, there are some books that do get canonized later than others, though I would still argue all of them very early. So, for example, Among these earliest quotations, for example, there is very few, and in some eras, none references to 3 John. The book of Hebrews, there's some dispute. You can find places in the ancient church where they have not rejected the book of Hebrews, but they are holding it at arm's length. And that bothers some people, that worries some Christians, but in fact, I think it should probably have the opposite effect. And here's what I mean. What it tells you is that the early church was not blindly, the 27 books we have, they aren't just the 27 books we happen to get. So, you know, it's not like, well, there were 5 different versions of the church with 5 different versions of the Bible, and only one version won the battles, and that's who we are. It's not that at all. The early church was actively applying criteria by which they determined which books belonged in the canon of Scripture and which books were excluded. And the number one rule, if you will, in that criteria was apostolicity. Was the book written by an apostle, or can you draw a direct line from that book to an apostle? And they were unsure as to who the author of Hebrews was, and therefore they were very cautious about allowing it into the Scripture, even though there's nothing the least bit objectionable in the book of Hebrews. It's a bunch of chapters of how awesome Jesus is. And so they weren't objecting to the content, but even a great book like Hebrews, if they could not positively say this was written by an apostle or connected to an apostle, they were very, very cautious about accepting it. And that should give you actually great confidence that when you crack open the New Testament, it's not a haphazard collection of books. You are actually looking at the works that both the apostles and the early church determined. These are the works of the apostles. This is the Scripture.
All right. Well, that's talking about the New Testament. Is there anything we might want to say about the Old Testament canonization? In a very short podcast.
Yeah, no, I usually, when people ask me about the Old Testament, I say, ask Dr. Link. But no, for me, I'm gonna take a complicated matter and simplify this dramatically. And here's what I tell my students, because we don't have time to do Old Testament canonization and New Testament survey, but here's what I tell them. The reason why the Old Testament I read has the 39 books in it, which is the standard Protestant Old Testament. And the reason why I affirm that canon is because I am convinced that that is the Bible that Jesus had. When I want to read the Old Testament that Jesus was reading, and I want to read the Old Testament the apostles were reading, and that is the Protestant Old Testament, the one with the traditional 39 books, without the Old Testament Apocrypha, the Maccabees and all that, because there's no indication. Jesus over and over again talks about the law, the prophets and the writings. He talks about the Torah. He uses those kinds of words in Greek, and you can build a case, I think, from even just the teaching of Jesus that the Old Testament we have, which is the Torah, and then the prophets, and then, you know, with the 12, and then the writings, that is the Bible that Jesus had. And for me, Dr. Link can teach his class, but for me, I'm happy with just to read the Bible Jesus was reading.
Yeah, I think that's helpful for us who, certainly we could go more in depth, and we have scholars like Dr. Link and other Old Testament scholars that could really address those issues.
Absolutely.
But from a very simple perspective, I like this way of thinking about it. If it was clear that this was the canon that Jesus was reading, then we can have confidence that it's the canon that we should be reading as well.
Absolutely, and it is the canon that the apostles and the rest of the New Testament quote and exegete.
All right. Well, so we've been talking about canonization, and I think we've already got at this a bit with what we're hearing around this, but why is this something that we should be concerned about as gospel-focused Christians?
Yeah, well, I mean, you there's two things, right? And you said one of them quite well, which is there are people love to talk about the canon. It was primarily sequestered into academia, you know, the halls of academia, the questions of when it was the canon, was canonization done late? Was there a political process? Do we have the Bible we have simply because Emperor Constantine decided that we wanted to have that? And when you throw Constantine's name out there, things get real complicated because he's not exactly a hero of the faith in most eyes. And so there are, but those questions that were sort of sequestered away to academia made their way into the pop culture with books like The Da Vinci Code. And so when the Da Vinci Code book came out and became a bestseller, and then the movie came out and it's got Tom Hanks in it, for crying out loud, all of a sudden it now becomes a question in the public eye. and scholars like Bart Ehrman from the University of North Carolina now is on, you know, the Colbert Report and the Daily Show and on Good Morning America talking about these things. And so, of course, the History Channel and the Discovery Channel, they're going to follow suit. And so because there are lots of people who will say things like, well, the books of the Bible weren't collected until much later. They were collected for political reasons. Non-apostolic forgeries made their way into the New Testament. Those are difficult. They are serious challenges. Well, let me put it this way. If true, they are tremendous blows to the truthfulness of Christianity, and therefore it is important to know these issues and talk about them because there's really good reasons to believe that those claims are in fact not true, not even close to being true.
All right. And I think we've done a good job today in the short time we've had together of hitting some highlights of how we might go about explaining that to someone, that we can have confidence that the 27 books we have in our New Testament and the 39 books we have in our Old Testament are the books that God intended for us to have, and only the books that God intended for us to have.
Absolutely. I hope so. Yeah.
Well, there are a lot of other issues having to do with the history of the Bible and how we have the Bible, but I think we'll bring our conversation to a close today. Thank you so much for tuning in with us. We hope that you enjoy these podcasts, and we look forward to seeing you next time.